Time to check in now with our rural reporters. And this week we're heading into nature's playground with preschoolers who are learning life lessons about risk-taking and resilience at Bush Kinder. We'll taste tiny vegetables that are big on flavour with a grower who specialises in microgreens and meet a farmer who's found the perfect crop. He's producing premium capers and struggling to keep up with demand from some of the country's top chefs. Plus, we crack open vintage cameras to salvage their innards.
Parts have become a little bit of a problem, so I have been buying up cameras that were otherwise dead, and I have, I'm afraid to say, more than 2,000 dead cameras in my workshop in boxes in here that I'm not sure what to do with.
Oh my goodness, and you're harvesting them for their organs by the sounds of it.
More or less for organs, yes.
Keeping old cameras alive with organ transplant, that's coming up. But first, let's get down on our hands and knees and join the kinder kids in the bush at Buchan in East Gippsland.
As long as you can see Mum or Rosie or Cassie or Lauren, even if it's from quite a far way away, you can be safe, okay?
An excited group of youngsters is heading out to play. There's no safety fences and certainly no soft fall cushioning to break their fall. These children, aged between 1 and 5, are exploring in the great outdoors. Hello, I'm Mim Cook. I've come along to a bush kinder session at Buchan, a small rural community in Victoria's East Gippsland district.
It's a good old tree, isn't it? Look at all the roots. You're sitting on the roots of the tree. Could be a little spider, a little tiny little ant.
Hey? Educator Rosie Levings is leading these outdoor learning sessions. The children are climbing in trees, clambering on top of boulders. They're even running around with sticks in their hands. Rosie thinks it's important that the children are exposed to risky situations.
Swordgrass is the classic. They pull themselves up on the bank and they end up with bleeding fingers because they pulled the sword grass. That is an experience that hurts, but it's not the end of the world. It bleeds a lot, yeah, but it's not the end of the world, and you will never ever do that again. You will learn to grab nature to support yourself to get up the riverbank in another way, yeah? I allow them to have their things, learn through that, understand that nothing happened to me other than actually a band-aid on my finger, and just trust that the learning occurs and people are safe in this beautiful protected little bubble that is our bush kinder. And within that, they can learn to really become resilient, they can learn to self-regulate, they can learn to really connect and ground themselves and take risks, real risks, but themselves without being mollycoddled and wrapped in cotton wool and not having the experience of what it feels like when actually a rock does hit your leg or something like that, because it will happen. Life is full of people throwing rocks at you and you need to, you know what I mean?
Hi, Olivia.
Hi.
Can you tell me about where we are right now?
Bush kinder.
What does it look like?
Nature.
What sort of nature can you see?
Trees.
Is there something you really like doing in nature?
Play with Gracie.
What do you play?
Mums and sisters.
That sounds like a great game. Do you have a cubby house in the trees that you use?
Yes, over there.
What's it built out of?
Bark and sticks.
Did you help build it?
Yes.
Do you like being outside or do you like being inside when you're a kid?
Outside.
Why?
It's fun to play.
But what skills are they learning for future existence through this?
All on the physical spectrum is fabulous because I have 2-year-olds that can navigate themselves bare feet through the walking on dry riverbeds and rocks that before that they were actually very uncoordinated and no agility and no upper body strength to climb a tree. So all of that gets in a, such a fun way, just gets developed so naturally without me having to put up fake obstacle courses and, you know what I mean? That's so easy, you know.
I imagine their language, so hence their literacy, just expands here as well because they can talk and discover.
They can actually find their voice because they can be loud, but they can also find their silence because they listen. because nature talks to them. So suddenly we become silent because there's birds. So they learn new vocabulary in lots of different forms, but they also expand their literacy in the sense that their creativity opens. We learn how to make fires, and then we tell stories around fires, and often I invite the children to tell their story around it. Risk-taking is the biggest one here. They learn about fire-making, they learn about responsibilities.
I'd be like a robot.
Are you a robot? It's not just the children who need to build up their resilience and learn how to take risks. Rosie Levings says adults too need to be educated on being in the great outdoors.
Some people are frightened to go into nature and take on that responsibility to look after children, because somehow they never were connected to nature. So then it becomes this hurdle and this thing of how can I be responsible for kids walking on a riverbed and wobbling rocks if I'm not comfortable. So people that come to work with me, we talk about this and we talk, what are you comfortable with? Where's your limits? You know, because so that we're sure about it. I've had to work with some people that were really frightened at the beginning that a child might climb a tree. So we needed to talk that through and come to a place where we're comfortable with, you know. Research has now shown clearly that the first 5 years are so important in a child's life, so formative. Yes, we know.
Tom, just push me.
Oh, can you talk to Tom instead of me about that? Because I didn't push you, remember?
Hi, Grace. Why do you like coming and being here in nature?
Because I like the trees climbing. I like climbing it. I like being outside in nature.
We're a little bit too stuck in how we believe children need to be in our society. And because we're all a bit confused about that, and we don't have time for children anymore, we give them electronics and tablets and things as the quick babysitters. Justifying it by saying this is the future and this is where everyone is going to go to, but not really actually thinking about it and going, hang on a minute, what we're actually doing is taking time away from those children to just feel themselves, to actually just feel bored or feel happy or feel connected or disconnected. They're just dampened by that constant screen that forms them and traps them.
When the earth feels sad, I give the earth cuddles.
Wind up, cock the timer, release, and then run out in front of the camera. And here we go, 10 seconds later. Done.
Long before there were mobile phones, there were manual cameras. In those days, you had to wind the spool of film on by yourself, as well as set the focus button. Today, it's simply a matter of pointing your phone and pressing a button.
To load the film, open the back of the camera and place your cartridge with the film into the one side of it. Fit the tongue of the film into the take-up spool on the other side, and then you wind on a further 2 or 3 shots and you're ready to go.
Hi, I'm Jessie Davies. One man who knows only too well what a mechanical camera can do is Ben Vang. This keen photographer grew up in Denmark before moving to Australia in the late 1960s. He trained with the famous Kodak company, he became a camera repairer and moved to the New South Wales central west town of Dubbo for work. And now, after 37 years in the business, he's retiring from full-time work.
When we started, all the cameras were completely manual. It was all mechanical. Then autofocus cameras came in and the automatic focusing and automatic exposure came on the market, and we had to learn how to service that. This lasted then until, I suppose, about 15, maybe 18 years ago, and we could digital cameras started very slowly to come on the market, very expensive. After a few years, the writing was on the wall for many of the camera stores. If they couldn't follow the new trend and sell a huge number of cameras, then they were not going to survive.
As Ben Vang predicted, most of those camera shops didn't survive and work dried up. He set up a workshop in the garage of his Dubbo home and concentrated his efforts on repairing mechanical cameras for keen collectors.
So you've just started your retirement, Ben. How does that feel?
I don't think I have actually started it yet. It's because there are so many collectors of old cameras that I've been doing work for over the years, suddenly asking me, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? So I had to promise them that I would continue doing their work as long as I could take my time doing it. And they were all happy about that. The funny thing is, old mechanical cameras, if you do them well, they can last for another 50 years, perhaps 30 years, certainly. And because I'm one of the few left that actually know how to do the old cameras, I'm happy to continue for a little while yet.
So I'm in your workshop here in South Dubbo, Ben. There's a camera in front of you. Tell me about this camera and what you're fixing.
Well, this is probably one of the most popular cameras ever to be made, single-lens reflex cameras. It's a Pentax Spotmatic, and they came on the market in the late 60s. Mechanically, they are very sound, and if they are done up properly, fully serviced, lubricated, adjusted, they will continue working another 30 years without any trouble. Parts have become a little bit of a problem, so I have been buying up cameras that were otherwise dead, and I have, I'm afraid to say, more than 2,000 dead cameras in my workshop in boxes in here that I'm not sure what to do with.
Oh my goodness, and you're harvesting them for their organs by the sounds of it.
More or less for organs, yes. They have a lot of useful parts in them for people that like to tinker with small mechanical bits as a hobby.
So this camera that's sitting in front of you on your workbench, Ben, what types of parts does it need, or what exactly are you doing to it?
The most common parts in some of these older ones is the prism. The prisms have a silver coating. Over the years, that silver coating can go bad from sealing material that's inside them. So I salvage the prisms that have not been affected, clean them up, and they can then be used in a new camera.
And I'm just looking at the lens, Ben. There are what seems like hundreds of moving parts. It looks like the back of an old clock.
This is actually the shutter mechanism from the camera. Now, a shutter mechanism like this has over 200 parts in it. And to service that, you need to remove every single one of them, clean them by hand, lubricate them properly, fit them back in, and then readjust it all. I usually set aside about 3 days to do one.
And what is it about cameras that you love so much that has kept you going for decades and decades in the industry?
The first part of it was the magic of doing photography. I went from straight out of school into an apprenticeship in Denmark, and it was a photography apprenticeship that lasted 4 years, and I went through all aspects of photography. Some of the best parts were in the dark room developing pictures and see the picture appear as you had it in the developing fluids in the dark room. That was always magic. And I'll continue being interested in that for as long as I can see.
Vintage camera repairman Ben Vang. He's officially retiring, but his passion for cameras will no doubt live on. That story was from Jesse Davies in Dubbo in central west New South Wales. Still to come, we'll meet a grower of microgreens. They're tiny vegetables that pack a big flavour punch.
Microgreens are really any vegetable seed that's grown for 7 to 10 days and harvested ready to eat.
Vegetable grower Adam Tutt is thinking big to produce something really small. Really small. G'day, I'm Michael Kavanagh. From this shed at Bowraville on the mid-north coast of New South Wales, Adam Tutt grows microgreens for the restaurant trade. They're also popular with keen home cooks who want to add that something special when plating up. The microgreen seedlings look a bit like alfalfa sprouts when you see them here in their growing out trays. But when you bite into them, they pack a real flavour punch.
Yeah, they're radish, broccoli, snow peas, traditional vegetable seeds. They're just grown to the microgreen stage. It's a two-leaf stage called cotyledon. Yeah, they're ready to eat now.
Right in front of me, it looks like what we'd call sprouts or alfalfa that you'd find in a health food shop, but in fact it's broccoli. When you harvest it in 7 days, will they look anything like broccoli?
They don't look like broccoli. They're just at the two-leaf stage. They taste a lot like broccoli, though. They're packed full of flavour and nutrients.
While you're talking about this, I'm going to try one of the broccoli, and I've got to get rid of the roots. I don't want to actually eat the dirt. And I chew into it. Yep, you swear yourself you're eating broccoli. Now, what's the advantage of these? They look fantastic. There's the red radish here that has got, I assume, a normal radish taste, and I chew into that. Yep, I'm getting that spicy radish taste. What's the aim of microgreens?
Microgreens, they look great on the plate. We all eat with our eyes, and presentation's everything in the chef industry. People like to recreate that at home as well and put some effort into their meals. And microgreens allow you to do that very easily. They add flavour, very strong flavour, and beautiful presentation to their dish.
You're talking about colour and presentation, and I've moved from the broccoli. Now, you've got three types of radishes here. The one that's obvious is the red radish. What about the other two?
The other two just give a contrast in colour. So we've got a green radish. It's like a Japanese sprouting radish. We've also got another green radish, but this one's got a pink stem. We like to blend them together, and we call that our rainbow micro mix. Looks beautiful on the plate.
You get the seedlings. There's a process of, what, they're kept in the dark and then they're moved to the shed?
Yeah, that's right. We soak them in water for the first 4 hours just to get the seed to germinate, and then we keep them in the dark the first 5 days of their life, and that makes the microgreens shoot up for the sun. We get a nice long stem able to be picked up and placed in the perfect position by the chefs on the plate. The last 2 days of their life, they're exposed to the sun. The little leaves open up. You get a fantastic looking little microgreen.
If you left, for example, the radish or the broccoli to keep growing, would they end up looking like the traditional broccoli?
Yeah, they've been seeded so densely in these trays, they probably wouldn't get there. But if you wanted to plant a seed individually, it's exactly the same seed that we use for microgreens as you would use for a full-grown broccoli or radish.
Once these are ready for harvest and they look as though they're not that far off, you go into your packing shed and you do packing a little bit differently. So let's wander into the packing shed and have a chat about that.
Yeah, let's go.
Adam, we're now in your packing shed, and in front of us, it looks like one of those old lawnmowers that you'd get on bowling greens that would have the green fabric catcher to get the grass. Now, obviously, you're not catching the grass, and there's also short rope that spin around.
Yeah, this is our greens harvester. We can push through a tray at a time in about 1 second. We can harvest our microgreens perfectly cut to the right height. It makes it very easy.
They go into the catcher, and then over here, for want of a better description, is an old-fashioned bathtub, but with a spa.
Yeah, that's right. We do blends, and we like to make sure our microgreens are nice and clean. So we've got an old bathtub. We've hooked up a jacuzzi pump. We add the microgreens in, blend them together. We wash off any dirt or seed husk that might be left over.
They have a jacuzzi. By this stage, they must be very content.
Yeah, they are. They're very content. But we need to get them dry so that they have a long shelf life. Our microgreens have 2 week shelf life, and the next stage is an old washing machine.
This is not very high tech. You're drying them using the standard washing machine that you'd find in a family laundry. How does that dry them out?
We've added a removable container, a bucket, and we put the microgreens into that on spin cycle. And it's just centrifugal force. All the water's rinsed off like you were washing your clothes. We dry our microgreens on spin cycle. And then the next stage, once we've got all the water off, we dry them on the air racks.
And once they're packed, you've got to get them off fairly soon to the supermarkets or the restaurants, because there's not that much of a lifespan in your microgreens, is there?
Our microgreens, they last for at least 2 weeks. So, yeah, we do. We pack them up and we get them off as soon as we can, like within 24 hours to the supermarket shelf, so that people can have their microgreens ready to eat, nice and fresh.
Okay. What's your favourite microgreen and how do you like serving it?
I really love just the radish, the rainbow radish mix, which is a mixture of the purple, the green and the red arrow. I love that on everything. I actually feel guilty if I'm not putting it on something because we've got so many microgreens here on the farm.
Helen and I wanted a little retirement hobby, something we could work on. We wanted the perfect crop for the Riverland, of course, because the food scene was just getting going back in the late 2000s.
And what Retirees Berry and Helen Porter settled on was growing caper bushes. These hardy dark green plants with their distinctive flower buds, so popular in Mediterranean cuisine, are perfect for the hot, dry climate of South Australia's Riverland.
We basically set a criteria of what we wanted and started looking and eventually settled on capers, something we could do some work on ourselves, very little water, handle our extremely hot summers, and because they're deciduous most of the time they can handle our frosty winters. So basically we think we lucked onto something really good.
Hello, I'm Jessica Schremer. The Porters planted their first 200 caper bushes on their Balmera property 12 years ago. They started out small but quickly developed a reputation for producing a premium product. Their plantation is now 5 times its original size and they still can't keep up with demand.
Well, when we started, we planned to do a couple of farmers markets and perhaps have a couple of retailers and, if we were really lucky, a chef or two. We're about 5 times the size that we were, and 90% of our production now goes out to top chefs around Australia.
It's not just the pickled edible flower buds or capers that the Porters produce. They've also found a ready market for the stems and leaves.
In Greece and Turkey, they're just used as a salad accompaniment, but because I've developed this pickling technique where they turn out crisp, green, fruity. A lot of the top chefs in Australia now use them, say, on a skewer between lamb, like George Columbaris. Heston Blumenthal uses them with octopus. Matt Moran in Sydney loves them in a steak tartare instead of the capers. And some of our local chefs in the Barossa, they go extremely well with South Australian kingfish, especially tartares. And even at home, pickled caper leaves chopped up and mixed through some smoked salmon. Really nice.
How much are you expecting to harvest?
Probably 100 kilos plus 35 to 40,000 stems of caper leaves. And if I'm lucky this year, we might harvest some caper berries.
Can you meet demand for your product?
No. I could double production tomorrow and still get rid of everything. I actually have a waiting list of chefs.
Looking at that waiting list, like looking into the future, are you thinking about expanding or are you happy where you're at the moment?
I have a couple of extra growers who do things my way and I can pay them a very good price off the farm for their product, and I sell that with ours. Hopefully one of those growers will be producing a lot of berries because I get a huge amount of interest in them. They really are delicious, but I don't produce many because I pick most of the caper buds before they get to the berry stage.
And are you producing different varieties of capers?
No, everything we grow here is the Caparis spinosa, spiny caper, which when you're around the Mediterranean or the Northern Hemisphere, that's all they seem to grow is these very, very prickly caper plants. We have the same variety out here, but the Australians, we've bred the spikes out of them. In Europe, they send the women out to pick because in their oldest clothes because they really are nasty, spiky plants. Whereas here in Australia, we very seldom find anything with spikes on.
Barry Porter, who's been growing caper bushes in South Australia's Riverland and selling their berries to top chefs around the country. That story was brought to you by Jessica Schremer, and I can attest to how good they are because I used to buy them from the Riverland Farmers Market.